So to begin, we will ask Torella Deborah Oswabeni to come forward. Torella was born on April 4th, 1993, on the day this country marked the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis. Like Dr. King, who was a dreamer, Torella also plans of greatness as she plans to add value to the lives of others by becoming a sports medicine orthopedic surgeon. Torella is a junior at Westerville Central High School, where she serves as a class officer, a member of the junior mentoring program, and the principal's advisory leadership team. She has been part of the varsity cross country and track team since her freshman year and is affiliated with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Along with that, Torella has been a scholar athlete since seventh grade and has maintained a 4-point grade average since sixth grade. She is joined here today by Mr. and Mrs. Tony Oswabeni, and Torella is the 2011 Martin Luther King Jr. Oration Contest in the senior division in the Columbus area. And she, in April, I believe, is attending the state competition for this contest as well. So we welcome Torella to the podium to give her winning oration. Torella.
Good afternoon. The title of my oration is What Do I Stand For? Martin Luther King Jr.'s life has inspired us greatly. It has inspired us to the point where the history of the civil rights movement cannot be talked about without the mentioning of his name. King believed in a struggle for peace, a fight for justice that was beyond himself. He believed in a dream that seemed impossible at the time. He believed that one day, little black boys and little black girls would hold hands with little white boys and little white girls and live in peace. He believed that one day, people would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. He believed in a dream that seemed impossible at the time, something he could not do alone. This dream has been made manifest during my lifetime. So what does Martin Luther King's life mean to me? King's life comes with a testimony that greatness can be achieved and peace and nonviolence can conquer all. His life challenges me to look at my life and ask myself if the things I stand for are worthwhile. King's life asked me the question, what will I stand for? He stood for justice, peace, and equality in America while toiling and giving his life for the cause. His life dares me to look at my life and ask myself if the things I stand for are worthwhile. When I think about the things I want to accomplish, I force myself to rethink the reasons for which I want to accomplish them. Will they ameliorate not just my life, but the lives of others? Or will they only encourage selfish notions, I ask myself. King used his life to make the lives of others better. That encourages me to be compassionate and to fight for others. I remember when I was young, my father would play King's speeches and sermons over and over whenever we went for car rides. King's booming voice resonated in persuasive tones that made you want to believe in anything he had to say. He talked about the freedom that was due everyone. To be free from the fears that tell me that I can't accomplish anything because of my color, but King's beliefs teach me that color is not a factor with regard to what I can do with my life. My capabilities are not to be hindered by the thought that I'm inferior to others. Heeding that, I take from King the lesson that I can do anything I set my mind to. King believed in the impossible at the time. African Americans acquiring equality through justice despite segregationist policies. Now we sit here today in this hall celebrating the multi-hued equality his massive struggles brought to life. I see different colors everywhere, and that is beautiful. King would be proud to know that his dream is being accomplished today. I want to believe like he did in the impossible. From what I have learned from his life, when you believe as King did in the impossible, it is bound to happen. Thank you.
Yeah.
gonna follow that?
Terrell, I have to follow that. That's great. That's wonderful. And we know that the medical community is going to have a real asset in you. Thank you for sharing with us. And I welcome everyone here. On behalf of Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, I think all of you are aware that the chief is under the weather and was unable to be here with us today. But I know she's here in spirit, as we are here to honor the third annual Black History Month celebration. And I know many of my colleagues are here. Justice Terrence O'Donnell is sitting with us. We have Justice Paul Pfeiffer, who was our acting chief this morning. Justice Stratton, I know, was planning to attend. Right there. Good. And any of the other justices.
Bob's in the bathroom.
Justice Cup is here.
There he is.
Oh, there he is.
He was combing his hair.
We had a rather lengthy morning session, and I know some of our participants are here. We welcome you as well. As you know, we kicked off the very first event in 2009 with former Supreme Court Justice Robert Duncan, the first African American to serve as a justice on the Ohio Supreme Court. He recounted his personal experiences of growing up in segregated times and his incredible changes that he's witnessed in his lifetime. And in 2010, we followed that presentation with a panel discussion at which several African American armed forces, the veterans, spoke of the impact of the famed Tuskegee Airmen on their military careers, a fantastic program. And this year is no different as we continue our distinguished lineup of speakers for Black History Month. But I need to note that one of our own staff members, Melissa Pierre Lewis, was one of the first individuals to begin this program. And so we thank her for this opportunity that we have to get together every year. And we, of course, honor our special guests with us today, the distinguished members of the John Mercer Langston Bar Association. Thank you for being here. This group of attorneys represents the Columbus affiliate of the National Bar Association, which we know as the oldest and largest national association of African American lawyers and judges. And as you might have guessed, the local chapter is named after Mr. Langston, an Oberlin College graduate, a statesman, and a lawyer. We also do thank the members of the committee for organizing and planning this event. Finally, I have the great pleasure of introducing today's featured speaker. And this is the very first time that I have the opportunity to introduce my rope sister, Yvette McGee Brown, at an event, and I'm thrilled to do that. At the Chief Justice's swearing in on at the Justice's swearing in, I should get that straight, on January 8th, it was as if the entire Columbus community was there to welcome her and celebrate. It was really a day of celebration. And we celebrate the fact that she's the first African-American woman justice. The room just swelled in pride, Yvette, with your accomplishment. And you have certainly done Columbus proud. And we're also very blessed that she's agreed to speak today to us. History is going to record her achievements, just as it also notes that she follows the former Justices Duncan and Lloyd O'Brown. And Yvette is the third African-American member of Ohio's High Court. The groundbreaking path that has marked Justice McGee Brown's life and career is remarkable. She was the first African-American elected to the Franklin County Domestic Relations Juvenile Court. She was elected by the peers of her court to a newly created position of the lead juvenile judge to improve court program and services. She also founded the first of its kind center for child and family advocacy at Nationwide Children's Hospital. And with her addition, we have just the third ever female majority in the Ohio
Supreme Court in the history, and this time we will make it stick. In Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor's swearing in remarks, in her vision of the judiciary, she highlighted the need to focus on developing diversity in the legal profession and on the bench in order to support access for justice for all Ohioans. And I know that Justice McGee Brown possesses rare insight into these issues, and I know that we're going to benefit tremendously from that knowledge and perspective. Already, she has shown her leadership skills and a willingness to try new ideas as a member of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Her depth of experience on the bench and her interest in juvenile issues and the domestic court is invaluable, and it rounds out our perspective as we deliberate the current members of the court. Her service on the community and corporate boards in private sector and government positions gives us a special breadth of experience that we need. And I know that Justice Stratton, who served with Justice McGee Brown for several years on the Dave Thomas Adoption Foundation National Board, also talks about her sense of humor, and we've already experienced much of that in our deliberations so far. As one of her former teachers recently wrote in a letter to the editor, Ohio will benefit from her experience and her keen knowledge of the law. We will also benefit from the diversity that she brings to the court. Please join with me in welcoming Justice McGee Brown.
Thank you very much, Justice Lansinger. I will start by saying how much I'm enjoying my colleagues on the bench, and this has been an amazing experience, and what a year. So I'm glad that all of you are here. I know we have some time constraints, so I will try to hurry things up, but I do want to take your questions if you have them. It's a great opportunity to ask me anything you want. I'm very candid. I will answer your questions and get you back to work. Let me first start by thanking the members of the John Mercer Langston Bar Association for being here. I'm going to do this to Aaron, because I do it every time. Aaron Granger, stand up, is a partner at the law firm of Schottenstein, Zox & Dunn, but he started with me. He was one of my first law clerks, and I take complete credit for his success. So every time we're in the same room, I say that. Everything that he's achieved is because I taught him. And Janine Jones is here, who's also one of my proteges, never worked with me, but is with Fricker and Eckler. So I appreciate both of you being here and hearing a speech you've probably heard a thousand times. Torella, wow. Despite the fact that you were born in 1993. What an amazing speech, and what a mature young woman. One of the things I'm gonna talk about today, and I would say this to you, to always remember, you know, a lot of people talk about going to med school and then they get a little afraid and they think, oh my God, it's so hard. And medical school is just like anything else in life. You get up every day, you go to class, you try your hardest, and you make it through. It is really about perseverance. Don't let anybody tell you can't do it. And as my grandmother would say, when my college professor suggested that I go to law school, I said to her, 3 more years of school? Are you kidding? I'll be 25 years old. I don't want to be in school till I'm 25 years old. And my grandmother used to sit in this chair and crochet, and she didn't even look up. She's just sitting down there crocheting, and she says, well, if you're going to live to be 25 anyway, why not be 25 and be a lawyer? So I would say that to you. When it feels like you can't open one more book, you can get it out of the way, and by the time you're 26 years old, you'll be a physician, you'll be able to do whatever you want. So, as somebody who has hit her 50th year, 26 is very young. So, let me just start by saying to you that as I thought about what I would say to you, and the committee asked me to really talk about my own personal journey, the one thing I guess you'll hear is a constant theme in my remarks today, and I think it fits with what you said about Martin Luther King Jr. and all of the heroes that we celebrate throughout our history. My personal favorite is Harriet Tubman. I admire her so much because she reminds me of my grandmother. She was not a learned woman, but she was a strong woman. And even when she had made her own way to freedom, she didn't forget others. And she went back to rescue over 300 people. And I've kind of seen my own journey in that way because, you know, when I was born in 1960 here in Columbus, the world could not have imagined that one day I would sit on the Ohio Supreme Court. In fact, it was funny, in December, I was talking to a friend when I was trying to decide if I should join the Supreme Court, and I was saying to him, he and I used to work together in the Attorney General's office, and I said, I don't know if I want to be on the Supreme Court. I mean, really, should I do that? Do I want to go back and put the robes on? And he looked at me and he said, really? He said, how about we get some perspective here? He said, 25 years ago when we were sitting in the Attorney General's office, did you ever think that one day you'd be saying, I don't know if I want to be on the Supreme Court. I don't know if it's what I want to do. He said, Yvette, get a life. This is what you're going to do. And so it's so funny how things work out because, you know, when I thought about where my career would go when I was in law school, I actually thought I wanted to be a litigator. That's what I thought I was going to do. I was going to be this big-time trial lawyer, be in the courtroom. You know, there's a little ham in me, so I loved being in front of an audience. But it wasn't as fulfilling as I thought, particularly when I thought about having children and being married. Working 16 hours a day was just not the path that I wanted to choose. And then I thought about Judge Duncan. And doesn't God have a sense of humor that I would follow in his footsteps? 33 years ago, I met Judge Duncan when I was 17 years old, when he was a federal judge in the Marconi Courthouse. And 33 years ago, I was a senior at Mifflin High School, and up until that year, I had attended school on half days. I went to middle school from 1 to 6, and I went to high school from 7:30 to 12:30 in the same building. And in 1976, Judge Duncan declared the Columbus Public Schools segregated. Now, as somebody who attended a predominantly African-American school, I never saw our schools as segregated. I had teachers who believed in us, teachers who encouraged us, teachers who made it their mission for us to get to college. And so when it came time for me to do my senior government paper, I decided I was going to do it on the desegregation work. And so with all the bravado of a 17-year-old, not really understanding what a federal district court judge was, I picked up the phone and called him. And he took my call. And I told him I wanted to come and interview him about his decision, the desegregation case. And he agreed to meet with me. And back then, you know, tape recorders were this big. So I traipsed down to Marconi with my big tape recorder and my legal pad. And for over an hour, I challenged a federal district court judge as to why he was busing us. Why my two brothers were going to have to be bused up north to Beechcroft High School. Why couldn't he just make our schools better? Why did we have to go to different schools? And he was so patient, and he was so kind, and he answered every question. And I thought from that day forward, not only was he going to be one of my mentors, I had no idea that later he would become one of my friends. And he is the kind of judge that I have patterned myself after throughout my career, because whenever anybody calls me to meet with them, I always do. I always go to speak at schools. I always do things for young people because there was nothing that I could give to Judge Duncan. Yet he took time with me and in that hour inspired me to think of what my future could be differently. And the fact that he took that time, I give a lot of credit to how I've developed my own judicial philosophy and the things that I've done in this community to make things better for those people who come after me. Because that's really what life is all about. 50 years ago, nobody would have imagined that this kid born to a poor teenage African-American mother could go to law school, could become a judge, and end up on the Ohio Supreme Court. But what I learned from my youth is that it's all about tenacity. It's all about believing in yourself and not always looking at what you don't have, but looking at what you do. Because even though I didn't have a father, I had a very strong mother and a very strong grandmother. And the gift that my grandmother gave me, a woman who was born in 1906 on a sharecropper's plantation in Macon, Georgia, a woman who did not have letters behind her name, who worked in restaurants and took in other people's laundry to support her 8 children while being married to my alcoholic grandfather, a woman who never complained about what life had given her and her lack of opportunities, spoke to me every day that I could remember that I could be anything I wanted to be if I was willing to work harder than anybody else for it. She was a woman who told me to go to school every day and learn everything those teachers had to teach me, because once they taught it to me, they could never take it back. She was a woman who let me know that life wasn't fair, that I was going to have to work twice as hard to get to the same place, but if I was willing to roll up my sleeves and work while others slept, that there was nothing that I couldn't be. And I thank God for her breathing that hope in my life. And she was a woman of faith, because she believed that if you prayed and you applied work to your prayers, that success would come. And so I was one of the fortunate ones, because my grandmother gave me the ability to look at the future and to look at possibilities. And that's what I try to give back to other young people, because none of us get to choose who we're born to, our economic circumstances, or what happens to us in life. The only thing we do get to choose is how we respond to it. And I am somebody who believes in always looking at the glass half full. You know, when I left Children's Hospital last year to run for lieutenant governor, people thought I was crazy. Why would you do that? Why would you give up such a great job? In fact, Aaron, I remember your email still. Aaron sent me an email saying, there's this rumor going around Capitol Square that you're running for lieutenant governor. I just told them they are crazy. And I couldn't respond to it for several days because it wasn't public. But let me tell you why I did that. Because, you know, if I look at my life, I get bored easily. One of the things my grandmother instilled in me is work. And I'm not somebody who can just phone it in. I've never been somebody who can just go to work and go home. I need challenge. I need something that requires me to really dig into it and to roll up my sleeves. And so I had been at Children's Hospital 8 years. I'd been on the bench for 9 years. I'd been with the state before that 6 years. I have about a 6 to 8 year window, and then I'm bored. And so I'm not predicting anything here. I'm sure there'll be enough to keep me interested. But when this opportunity came, it was all about timing. It came at a point where I was looking to do something different. I hadn't planned for that to be running for statewide office, but I thought of it this way, and this is what I would share with you. I was turning 50 in 2010. I thought, even if we don't win, what an amazing experience. And it did not disappoint. I mean, I can tell you that it was probably the hardest year of my life, but the best year of my life. I hung out with the President of the United States. Who gets to do that? I'll be able to tell my grandkids that I got to hang out and fly on Air Force One with the first African-American president. I've been on Air Force Two twice with Joe Biden, and I gotta tell you, he's lots of fun. He calls me kid, but he is the real deal. I mean, Joe Biden, wherever we would go, would stop and speak to the servers and to the police officers. He would always take time with them. And then I think maybe the biggest highlight next to the president was Bill Clinton. I got to spend 2 full days with Bill Clinton, and ladies, he still got it. All I'm saying. He is magic. He's got these blue eyes. I mean, and when he talks to you, you feel like the most special person in the world. But imagine, I was on his plane with him, and I talked to him about his humanitarian work. And to have the chance to talk with somebody like Bill Clinton and have him tell me what some of his biggest regrets were being the President of the United States, dealing with the world conflict. I mean, one time we were on Air Force Two and Joe Biden excuses himself to take a call from the Prime Minister of Israel. I mean, to be a witness to history as it's unfolding like that is something you can never replace. So what I would say to all of you gathered here is that you have to look at life as a journey. I knew this. I knew that if we lost, that I was a lawyer, and I would always be able to feed and clothe myself. I didn't imagine I'd join the Ohio Supreme Court, but I knew that I would be able to find a job, and I'm so glad that I said yes to the experience. I would encourage all of you to think about what's that next thing you want to do, because we all create history every day of our lives. It's not the big names. It's the individuals. When you talk about my swearing in, I did it intentionally at the Martin Luther King Center because I stood in that place, yes, because Robert Duncan stood in this place, but because of people like my grandmother who ironed other people's shirts or worked in hotels or were servers and cooks. They gave me the ability to stand in this place. So each of us have the ability to create history and opportunity on our own. It depends how hard you're willing to work and how much risk you're willing to take, because there is risk. But I think if you take calculated risk, you will find your life so enjoyable. Now, by taking calculated risk, I don't mean if you can't sing, you know, quit your job and go on American Idol. And if you're 5'6", don't think your kid's gonna be in the basketball leagues. I mean, there are some realities to it, but understand that there's lots of adventure and opportunity. And the one thing I know is when I look back on my life, I will be able to say that I've tried everything I wanted. I'm not done yet, though. I'm only 50. And so I think that there's going to be other things I want to pursue, but I'm going to do it with this in mind, that I think you always have to pay forward. You always have to be looking to give hope and opportunity to young people who, through no fault of their own, are born into circumstances that don't always provide a clear path. You know, if all you see around you is hope and devastation, it's really hard to believe that you can be a lawyer or a doctor or a business person. We have the ability to give that hope to young people and to really take the time and work with them one-on-one. It doesn't require a big title. It doesn't require anything but the investment of your time. And so when we think about Martin Luther King Day or we think about Black History Month, I think all of us need to think about what are we doing to make the world better, much like our young speaker said. What are we doing to add value to the world? Because this is what I want them to say when I leave this earth, that I tried to make a difference for somebody. That there's a lot of Aaron Grangers running around whose career I can take complete credit for. who are making a difference in other people's lives, that we've had a chance to connect. And so just like my college professor that encouraged me, just like my biology teacher who saw something in me before I could see it in myself, just like Robert Duncan who took the time to invest in a 17-year-old who disagreed with his learner decision, all of us have the ability to instill hope and to inspire. I hope that you will do that every day. And if you're in a job, hopefully you're not because the Supreme Court's wonderful, but if you're in a job where you think you can do more, go do it. Don't wait for tomorrow. If there's something you want to do and you need new skills, go get the skills. If there's some journey you want to take but you're a little afraid, jump off. Go do it now while you're still young enough to enjoy it. And understand that fear is your biggest obstacle. The thing that holds us back most is us. If you're willing to confront your fears, you can be anything you want to be, just like my grandmother used to say. So for me, I wish you all a great Black History Month. I will take your questions, but I know we got to get back to work and we have conference. So thank you very much. So is there anything you're not, yes?
What was the best, strangest, most interesting campaign story you can tell?
Oh, wow, let me think. The best, most interesting. I think the one that I remember that I think impacted me the most, there's a funny one and then there's this one. The one with Bill Clinton when we were sitting on his plane. I said to him, I said, you know, Mr. President, you've lived three lifetimes. You've been a governor, you've been president for 8 years, and now you're this worldwide humanitarian. And at the time I was reading the book, Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars. And I asked him, I said, I can't imagine what it's like to get that presidential daily briefing every morning and seeing all of the threats to the United States and that are going on in the world and still have to make decisions, but then go out and put a smile on your face. And I said, you know, I don't know how any one person takes all that in. And so as we were talking, he said, you know, one of the biggest regrets I have is about Rwanda. And he actually got, first of all, this is a man with an amazing memory. I mean, he, wherever we went, he saw people that he could call out by name that he hadn't seen one, in one instance since high school. But he gets a little misty and he says, you know, when you're the president, you get these presidential daily briefings and you have all of this information that flows into them from the CIA, the DIA, the NIS, all these alphabet soup. And he said, and just like with any bureaucracy, they over time start to focus on what they think you want to know. And so that tends to take up the majority of the report. He said, so when I was in office, it was all about Al-Qaeda and what was going on in Russia. He said, my biggest regret is I didn't know about Rwanda until 850,000 people had been murdered. And he said, and I'm not talking about shot down. He said, I'm talking about machete murders. And he said, had I known, had we had any concept of the devastation, we would have gone in sooner. And we would have saved half those people. He said, and I think about 850,000 people being killed like that. And in his travels now, he met a woman who was a survivor of Rwanda. And this is where he really, I mean, he could hardly hold together. He said, this woman, he said, when you want to think about the humanity of people, he said, this woman was raped in front of her 9 children. And then after they raped her, they made her watch as they macheted to death each of her 9 children. And yet this woman came up to him when he was over there with joy, warmth, and helping others caught in desperate situations in her country. And he said to him, it just demonstrated that deep well of humanity that we all have. And when you could see that pictured in her after everything that she'd gone through, he said it just made him believe in the goodness of people again. And so I think that is probably of all the memories I have to get that kind of conversation with President Clinton, I will never forget that. One of my funnier moments was visiting the Canfield Fair. And I'm still trying to get off fair weight from this campaign, but the Canfield Fair had a reenactment of the Civil War. I mean, literally, these people live in tents for like 2 weeks on the grounds dressed in Civil War garb. And so they kept trying to get me to cross the Mason-Dixie line. And I refused. So they wanted to take a picture of us with the Confederate Army, so I stayed. Like there was a little sign that said Mason-Dixie line. I stood right on the end and made them get behind me. And then after we took the picture, I looked at them and I said, well, I'd say good luck, but well, you know. So there were lots of great moments like that. And the people we met were phenomenal. Any other questions? Really? No? Yes.
I was wondering if your grandmother was still with us to see what your accomplishments are. How far did you go with her still here?
She only got to see me sworn into the bar. My mother was my grandmother's 7th of 8 children. And so she died. She got diagnosed with cancer in March of my 3rd year of law school. They told her she couldn't come to my graduation in May because she shouldn't walk up all those steps, and she told the doctor he could pound salt, and she walked up every one of those steps at Mershon Auditorium. She lived to see me sworn into the bar November 4th of 1985, and then she died on Christmas Day of 85. But, you know, I talk about her all the time, so I feel like she's with me. She was just an amazing woman. And we were very close because my mother was so young, and in fact, when I was in law school, I lived with her because I was just saying to some of the justices earlier that the reason I'm successful is because there was no YouTube or internet when I was in college, because I would have so gone down in flames. But to give you a glimpse of, I was a little bad in college, but my mother would not let me live with her when I decided to go to Ohio State's law school, because I said, okay, Mom, I'm going to Ohio State. She's like, great, where are you gonna live? I was like, I'm gonna live here. She said, oh, no, you're not. She said, my house is big enough for one woman, and that's me. You need to go find a house where you can be a woman. So I called Grandma. And so I lived with my grandmother while I was in law school, and so that was really the gift, because every night I would have dinner with her, and it was just really wonderful. So things worked out the way they were supposed to. And then my mother decided to start speaking to me again. That's a long story.
What was it like on your first day here at the Supreme Court?
Oh, my goodness. Well, Eve had tried to warn me about, you know, staying up on the reading and getting a system in place. It was, okay, so from a work standpoint, it was overwhelming. Although all of you, I will have to say, this is the nicest place I've ever worked. You are the best team of people. I mean, to a person, everybody was helpful, pleasant, just really a joy to work here. Emotionally, it was also a little overwhelming because I have to say, I really had never been in the justices' chambers except to come to the conference room with Chief Justice Moyer. And to walk into that chambers area and to see how beautiful it is, and to remember all that the chief went through to get this building done, and it's outstanding. And to think that I get to work here, it's still overwhelming. I mean, it's never in my life did I imagine I would be here. It just was not something that I ever thought would happen. So it was emotional, and the work was overwhelming. I didn't have time for too much emotion because they were calling me down to to conference, but yeah. All right. It is 1:25. Thank you guys so much for the privilege. I know this is probably a non-traditional Black History Month speech, but you've heard all the quotes from Malcolm and Martin. So I figured I'd just give you a little bit of my own advice, but I want you to know it's my joy to work here with you, and I look forward to doing that for many years to come. So thank you very much.